Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast, part one of a two-part megapod. I'm John Manuel, along with Connor Glassy and Nathan Rohde. They're in the podcast nook. I'm disembodied back in my office as we record this with three people. It's instead of just sitting around a hot computer like we used to, we're all actually trying to use microphones and headsets and stuff. So, guys, we're putting our first part of our draft preview to sleep today. Sleep being the operative word because we all didn't get enough last night as we write up our scouting reports and finalize this labor-intensive issue. But, you know, for me, it's probably the most fun issue, even when you sit in one place and write 7,600 words of scouting reports in one day, because I just feel like we're all so much, like, smarter now than we were, like, a month ago with all the phone calls and all the emails and the information we've been really bearing down on. We're just a single-minded, as Guided by Voices would say, surgical focus on the draft. And we've reported a lot of news lately, and so let's just dive right in with some of the news, and we can discuss as how it pertains to the class, because the guy, you know, you guys see all the high school players. You focused on Lucas Giolito as the number one player on the high school side, number two in the class coming into the spring. He got hurt in March, and Nathan, you talked to you know, Lucas's father, Rick Giolito. So Lucas is throwing again, and why don't you start, and then Connor, you talk about what you think Giolito's place is in this draft and if or when he might throw off an actual mound in front of actual scouts.
Well, in talking to Rick Giolito on Wednesday, Lucas started throwing for the first time on May 4th on flat ground. I think he threw about 60 pitches his first time out from a distance of 60 feet. He's still working at 60 feet right now, and there's no exact timetable as to when he will, you know, advance the distances or increase the number of pitches he throws or anything like that. But it's thought that in the next week or so, he'll move to 90 feet and then 120 after that. And like I said, with no exact time frame, it's also we're not sure when he'll open those workouts up because right now they've been private. Rick was there for some of them, but he even wasn't there for the duration or all of his workouts. It's really just Lucas doing his thing under the supervision of his doctors at the Curlin Job Orthopedic Clinic in Los Angeles. They also do a lot of work with the Angels, the Dodgers, the Lakers, you know, all the professional teams in the L.A. area, as well as, you know, Southern California Athletics. They gave Lucas a program to really focus on certain areas of his body to strengthen so that, you know, he's stronger in the future and, you know, is very preventative in terms of injuries. You know, they want him working on his shoulder, getting that stronger, getting his back stronger. And they even, you know, went over some video with him and kind of broke it down. And, you know, it's not that he had bad mechanics, but they just pointed out a few things that he should try to, you know, clean up just a little bit that might help him in the future prevent from having an injury, or as best you can prevent an injury in a pitcher these days.
Well, hearing all that, Connor, where would you take him in this draft with these CBA changes? We don't want to, you know, beat that dead horse, but with the state of this draft and this draft class, where, you know, in your mind, where does Lucas Giolito fit?
Well, that's the tough part because, I mean, the CBA obviously has to factor into it. Just because Giolito entered the season as one of the top guys, you know, maybe even having a possibility to be the first high school pitcher picked 1-1. So, you know, coming into the season, this is a guy who had pretty high expectations, you would think, of what he was going to get paid and what he's worth compared to everyone else. And so, you know, it just depends on how much, if at all, he's willing to lower that price tag and lower those expectations. But if he's not, then, you know, there's only certain teams that can really fit him into their budget if the team is gonna play by the budget that MLB put forth with the bonus pools. You know, I still think that if he's healthy, he's an absolute, you know, top five, top ten prospect because his stuff was just so good. But it's all going to come down to who's able to see him, first of all, because I think if a team is going to want to invest that kind of money in a high school player, they're going to want to at least get a look at him before the draft rolls around, and then who can you know, finagle him into their budget.
Hard to imagine for me that if he doesn't throw, like whether it's a game, a simulated game, some kind of, I just can't imagine him going in the first 10 picks, and then really, if he doesn't go in those first 5 to 7 picks, say, the bonus pool shrink after that, and it's really difficult to see, in my mind, guys, a team taking him and being able to pay him what it will take to keep him away from UCLA. Over under, I'm going to put his chances of attending UCLA at 75%. Nathan, over under.
Under.
Connor?
I got the under, too. You know, I did it right after he got hurt. I did a draft blog post kind of on this, and the one interesting team at the back of the first round, if he even falls as far as the Brewers,
right,
because they have 2 first-round picks, so maybe they can pick a signable player with one of them, somebody who's not expecting to be a first-rounder, and they can, you know, sign him and save some money there. But the other interesting aspect to that scenario with the Brewers is that their owner, Mark Attanasio, his sons both went to Harvard Westlake, where Giolito goes. So that's just kind of an interesting tie-in there.
It is a little bit of an interesting tie-in, and I like that as a that is a deep cut destination. I think that is a possible destination that will be a little bit bolder than your average Brewers draft class, if you ask me.
Mm-hmm.
I would be surprised if they do that, but I like the way you set that up a couple months ago, and it's a good one. Now, there are a couple other injury guys out there, and another guy who was in the top 10 to start the year was Victor Roach, the outfielder from Georgia Southern. You know, hit 30 home runs last year. So the college, so your offense in college baseball is down by 50%, and this guy becomes the first guy to hit 30 home runs in a season since 2003. It's quite a, when you really put it in that perspective, statistically, that was one of the crazy good seasons that we've seen in college baseball in an awfully long time. Mm-hmm. I don't care if he did it in the Southern Conference. He did it, and so he's in our top 10 for good reason. I know he struggled in the second half of the Cape Cod League last year. But, guys, this is basically a bat first. I wouldn't say bat only, but if you're drafting this guy, you're buying the bat, and it's a right corner outfield profile. You know how I feel about those. Not a lot of those in the big leagues who come out of college baseball. And on top of it, it's a power guy who has a significant wrist injury. That the way an area scout put it to me, it's not Cliff Floyd, but it's not Jackie Bradley Jr. either. It's not one where Jackie Bradley Jr. last year came back fairly quickly, whereas Cliff Floyd took him a year or two to really become Cliff Floyd again. And he'd already reached the major leagues. This is a guy who's still doing it with metal bats. So where do you guys think Victor Roach fits in here? To me, I think he's probably still going to go in the first round, but mostly because there are no college bats out there. And Connor, you talked to Victor Roach today. What was his mindset of his comeback? How did he sound to you, and where do you think he winds up going?
Yeah, I talked to him yesterday, and he was in great spirits. He sounded really upbeat. I think he has always maintained a positive outlook on this. I mean, I remember when I talked to him the first time around, when it first happened, he was still even upbeat. He said, hey, you know what? It happens. Players get hurt. I'm going to use this time to get better in other areas. And so he sounded good, which was good to hear. It sounds like he got his cast off about a month ago, and the first month, he said, has just been he's just been kind of doing, you know, strengthening, just kind of trying to get loose again, because it was his wrist had a couple pins in it, and it was totally immobile for the month he had the cast on. And so now he's just trying to kind of work through some of that stiffness. And then the next month, he said he can try and get stronger and get back to picking up a bat. He didn't really have a definite timetable on when that's going to happen, but it did sound like that he's going to try to pick up a bat and take some cuts, maybe at a pre-draft workout or two before the draft. So, like you said, I mean, there really aren't very many impact college bats in this class. So I'm with you. I still think he's going to be a first rounder just because of his track record and the fact that it's pretty slim pickings in that regard.
And I think, you know, Jim talked to, and we're going to, part two of the podcast, of the draft podcast, will be tomorrow morning. We'll record Friday morning. Jim Callis will join me here on the Skype chat, and we'll talk about the first round projection. But one of the quotes that Jim got from a scouting director this week was that this is the weakest college position player class in years, maybe in the last 20 years. I would posit it's the weakest since 2000, when your only college position players drafted in the first round that year were Joe Borchardt, who got a $5.3 million bonus, but wound up, I think it's fair to say, was a bust. Chase Utley, obviously, worked out, great career. And then David Parrish, who was a bust, who was really a guy that the Yankees forced up their draft board at 28. And then and the rest of the top 50 picks, the other college position players who were drafted that year were Tyrell Godwin, who got a cup of coffee to the big leagues. I'm going to count him, even though he's an indie leaguer. Bobby Hill would have been a college senior, but went my University of Miami, then Atlantic League, drafted by the Cubs in the second supplemental first round. Tag Bozide, who never quite made it. Longtime fan of Tag Bozide. Mike Tonis, Cal, cup of coffee, now on the Greek national team. Dane Sardinia. And Xavier Nady, ex-Nady, who was like a top college hitter on the board for a lot of teams that fell because of signability. And if you look back at that year's College All-America team, it really just tells you how brutal the class was. Like, one of the best careers by the college position players, besides Utley, who was on All-America team, who guys who were draft eligible, you're looking at guys like Brad Hopp and Joe Inglet as your other best careers. I mean, it was really a brutal college draft class. Nathan, Connor, you did the Carolinas and the Northeast. Connor, you did Puerto Rico and the West. Obviously, Puerto Rico not really a factor here for college position players, but are there enough college position players from your regions to make this a better year than 2000?
I don't really know. I don't think so. The college hitters in my region, you know, are interesting, but when you look at a guy like Chris Taylor at University of Virginia, you know, he can hit. You know, he's a solid hitter, but you're not looking at him, you know, because he's a college bat and he's advanced and he's going to go quickly to the big leagues because he's going to hit. I think he's going to hit, but I don't know if it's going to be really an impact bat. You're drafting him because he's a guy that likely stays at shortstop, provides you with good defense, has a plus arm, runs well. And the bat will be, you know, a solid part of his game. But then you have L.J. Mazzilli up at Connecticut. And, you know, he probably fits the profile more of kind of that advanced bat. But then you're also just talking about kind of an offensive-minded second baseman. And that's if, you know, he can develop his defense a little more. Right now there are questions about his defense and staying at second base. The scouts I've talked to aren't too concerned with it. They feel like they can get him into a pro system and really help him. Basically, he's waiting back on balls too much, and then he has to rush, which leads to errors, obviously. And then, you know, Tom Murphy, you know, he hasn't had the year people would expect out of him, but he's shown very good power in the past, you know, taking Kevin Gausman deep in that little showcase game against Team USA last year. But he's more of a, you know, another solid offense guy that, you know, everyone sees his solid catch and throw skills behind the plate. And, you know, he's kind of, I guess in a way, a poor man's Mike Zunino. He does a little bit of everything, but he's not, you know, quite at that same level.
He's got a better body than Zunino. I mean, he's more,
he's strong.
I think he's more athletic. I think he's more athletic. Athleticism is a question for Zunino, but mm-hmm. Like in the Northeast, like your guys coming into the year were guys like Travis Jankowski.
Right.
And he's kind of had a little bit of a down year. I mean, Murphy, like you said, Jeremy Baltz, Christian Walker, either of those guys got a shot to go in the first 10 rounds. Christian Walker, he fascinates me. If I'm taking a college first baseman, there's not a lot of good college first basemen. Mm-hmm. I understand where some would maybe prefer Preston Tucker. I wish I'd said this in our top 200 meeting the other day, but I almost think I'd take Christian Walker over Matt Snyder and Preston Tucker, even if he's a right guy.
Right. The question is, you know, how much power does Christian Walker really have? You know, South Carolina, everybody knows that that's kind of a bandbox down there. The ball really flies out, and you know, you look at Christian Walker's power numbers, and there aren't really they aren't really what you would expect for that position, much less that position in a favorable home park. Not to mention, yeah, he can handle the bat and he can hit a little bit, but you know, I know it's only, you know, one quick look, but I saw him swinging through 89 to 90 mile an hour fastballs from Ryan Stanek the other night on TV. So, you know, there are definitely some questions about the bat, even though you do like it. And then when you look at the overall profile, you kind of second guess yourself, I would say.
How about for you out west, Connor? You had Devin Marrero. Sounds like he's going to go in the first round, but we almost should call him a first-round glove as opposed to a first-round bat, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, John, going back to what you were talking about with this year lining up with the year 2000, the interesting thing is that this is another strong year for Northern California. And, you know, wasn't that the year where we did the Golden Gate Bridge cover?
It absolutely was the year that we did the coolest cover in college baseball preview issue history. With Tag Bozai, Joe Borcher, next 80. That really
We could have replicated it this year, you know, with Kyle Zimmer and Mark Appel and, you know, Stephen Piscotty or something like that. But
Stanford's whole team and Kyle Zimmer basically.
Yeah.
And the great Cal Bear, Tony Renda.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That those are the guys I was going to bring up first. Was the guys in NorCal with Piscotty and Tony Renda. Piscotty is interesting because he's another right guy, and he's moved to the outfield for Alex Blandino there at Stanford, and for scouts that's kind of a problem because he's not a great third baseman, but he profiles better at third base,
right?
More of a doubles guy than a slugger, but in the outfield it's a much tougher profile, being that, you know, the right you know, with not a lot of corner power. So
yeah, if you really looked, I mean, I loved from last year in the Cape Copley, I loved the Piscotty to Garrett Atkins comparison.
Yeah.
I really thought there was a lot of merit to that. Garrett Atkins was a good big leaguer for a few years where he was, you know, as long as he hit, his defense was passable. That's how it feels like Stephen Piscotty's going to be. Piscotty probably has a little bit more arm strength than Garrett Atkins.
Mm-hmm.
Probably similar level of athleticism, maybe a little bit better athlete, but maybe not quite as pure a hitter as Garrett Atkins. Garrett Atkins is a pretty pure hitter, and again goes back to this 2000 class as well, drafted the same year as Chase Utley. They were classmates at UCLA, so it's all coming back to 2000 right now. and the other guy who I think conspicuous by his absence in this discussion of college position players is the highest drafted hitter out of the 2009 high school ranks who went to college, and that's Kenny DeKroger, went to a four-year college. Connor, just explain to our listeners what happened. what happened to Kenny DeKroger? Why is Kenny DeKroger on this draft list for us on our preliminary top 200 below 5'8" Tony Renda?
Well, first of all, the hit tool separates them. I mean, scouts love Tony Renda's bat. I mean, and even before I was talking to scouts this year about Tony Renda, last year when I was doing draft calls, basically every Pac-10 coach, I mean, to a man, went out of his way to praise Tony Renda. I didn't bring him up. They just said, oh, and while we're talking about players, Tony Renda is awesome. I mean, that was basically how they all went. They all just wanted to tell me that they love this guy, and this was, you know, opposing coaches across the board pretty much. And then this year it's been the same thing from scouts. I mean, he just seems like he's such an easy player to root for. But I mean, tools wise, scouts also, I mean, they love his bat. He really hits. He has a knack for hitting. The other parts of his game aren't great. I mean, it sounds like he's just a passable defender at second base. But he runs the bases well, he plays hard, and you know, they like guys that can hit like that. So I think he's going to go pretty good, you know, maybe as high as the second round. But, scouts really like him. Other than that, though, in my areas, you mentioned Marrero down there in the Four Corners. That's really the only big-time college hitter down there, I believe. And then in the Northwest, it's really light for college players all around the Northwest, with Christian Jones getting hurt at Oregon. Oregon State's young. I think, you know, the top player I turned in from Washington as far as college guys was Jake Lamb, who's had a disappointing year. So it's just down all around for college baseball.
It's really on
the position side.
I think it really is, and from the Southeast, you know, the concentration for me was really the high school hitters. From a college standpoint, I mean, outside of Mike Zunino, it's a little bit thin. I'm just looking down our list, and, you know, Brian Johnson's a position player, but he's going to get drafted as a pitcher. Nolan Fontana, you know, he's going to go supplemental to late first round because he's safe, not a ton of impact there. And then you start talking about college seniors, guys like Peter O'Brien if he gets healthy, James Ramsey out of Florida State, who's kind of a split camp guy. And then Adam Brett Walker, I think Adam Brett Walker kind of is in that Tom Murphy discussion of a guy who, you know, last summer, and we had a great spring last year, just like Tom Murphy, big power, good body. You could get excited about him, but the more you saw him in the Cape, the more you saw him swing and miss. And this year it's been ordinary at Jacksonville. They don't face a lot of great competition in their conference in the Atlantic Sun. The league is very down this year. Their team is terrible at Jacksonville. It's been a disastrous year. And while he's put up good numbers, he just hasn't taken that next step. And, you know, whether he's a right fielder or a left fielder or a first baseman, there's a lot demanded of his bat. And with that much swing and miss, and then people really have questions on him. I think in a regular year, this would be a guy that scouts would be much more comfortable turning in as a third to fifth round pick. And instead, he gets pushed up into the second round consideration, and he's the best college first baseman on the board, which is kind of shocking when you really think about it. So it's just really hard to find guys in any of our regions. It feels like it's hard to find a guy who's really made a name for himself, who's really moved up. And like in the Southeast, the guy who's really moved up is DJ Davis, the Mississippi prep outfielder, who really, I guess, was it really last year at East Coast that he kind of burst on the scene? Was he a little bit of a known guy before that, but really raised his profile at East Coast where he ran a 6.3 860?
That certainly jumped out, and then I think him continuing to play at the Worldwide Bat Championships in Jupiter in October.
He played on a scout team. He played on a Mets scout team in the fall with David Dahl. They were teammates, and they played like a string of games against junior colleges in the fall. And DJ Davis and David Dahl owned those games, according to the scouts I talked to. Those guys were far and away the best players in the field against older competition. They had no problem handling, you know, those guys who were just a year older than them in some cases, junior college freshmen, but they had no problem handling velocity, handling a little bit better coached players. And, to me, that's where Davis kind of really made that big jump, and he's held it this spring. He was building momentum, and the fact that he's maintained it and even continued to get better this spring, he's the guy in the Southeast who seems like he's made the biggest leap. I mean, in your area, Nathan, is that Corey Seager, or is there somebody else in your area who's made a big leap forward?
And I definitely think, you know, it's Corey Seager. You know, early on, we were talking about him, and guys like him. They like the hit tool, the defense. You know, at shortstop, it's good defense, but it's probably even better if he moves over to third base. And he's strong. He really goes the other way with power. So guys like that, but it was kind of, there was this kind of vibe that he was unsignable. But now it's more, it sounds like he would be unsignable out of the first round, and now we're all thinking, you know what, he's a first round talent. You know, maybe even middle of the first round or higher, depending on the team. But he's certainly that guy that's kind of come on strong. And the other thing, Scott was telling me that, you know, he just does things so easy. Sometimes you feel like it's too easy for him and they're kind of a low motor. But in fact, you know, the game just comes so easy to him that he doesn't have to put a lot of effort into it. And it's not that he's lazy or, you know, a bad kid or anything like that. It's just, the game comes naturally to him, and, you know, scouts are beginning to see that.
Yeah, and it sounds like, Connor, for you out west, I mean, really not an obvious guy to me who's...
Well, Zimmer made the jump early.
That's it. You know, I wasn't looking that high.
Coming in this season, Zimmer made the jump early, and he's stayed there as the draft approaches. So that's probably the main guy in my area. And then, you know, some of the Puerto Rican guys I went down to see, I mean, Correa obviously was a big name coming in, he solidified that, but maybe one of the biggest risers is J.L. Berrios, a guy who wasn't on our high school top 100.
Right.
But he added about 20 pounds of muscle from the summer to now, And that really helped him. It didn't just help him with his velocity, which went from like 90-92 up to now he's sitting like 93-95, and I had a scout tell me he's even seen him touch 98. But it also helped with his delivery. I mean, he kind of had a little bit of a violent delivery in the summertime, and he's the added weight and the added muscles allowed him to smooth things out and throw more strikes. So now you're talking about a guy who's sitting, you know, low to mid-90s, touching 98 with a really sharp slider and a pretty good changeup. So he's a guy that I think, you know, we have him in the sandwich round as far as talent when we're lining up our top 200. But he's a guy that absolutely wouldn't surprise me if he jumps up into the first round for a team that's looking for a guy who is signable if they want to maybe save a little money for a pick later on.
And that's obviously it's going to be a part of tomorrow's podcast as well. I think Jim and I, we can talk a little bit tomorrow more about strategies that some of these teams are employing, because I don't think anybody really knows what's going to happen. I talked to Jeff Luno the other day, and he just said, anyone who tries to tell you what's going to happen between picks one, that their first pick, and 41, their second pick, is fooling. There's no way, because I think it's a very volatile. When the talent in the class, when everyone's got a flaw, everyone's got a hickey, it's going to come down to personal preference and what your scouts see, and it's going to be a very, I think, very unpredictable draft. It's a Baseball America podcast with John, Connor, and Nathan. Guys, let's talk a little bit about best tools. I don't know if you guys have your best tools in front of you, but it really did seem like this was one of the hardest ones to put together. Again, the college class, I don't want to bang on it too much, but I guess I do, because it's impossible to find any college athletes in this draft or college runners. I mean, who do we like? Who do we like? What was a category where you really had a hard time deciding on best tools, Connor, as the rest of us all as well gave you suggestions, and you lined up our suggestions from our regions? What was the toughest one? That was the toughest call.
You nailed it. I mean, the college athlete and the college, you know, fastest runner, and those obviously kind of go hand in hand. And, you know, that's a trend we've seen for the past several years, because teams have been doing such a good job of grabbing those athletes out of high school and signing those kids before they get to college. So, you know, we've seen a lack of athleticism in high school. And then with the fastest runners, I mean, I was amazed. Guys we are considering for our college fastest runners are, I mean, they're not burners, they're 60 runners. You know, we had to kind of scrounge around to find some plus runners that to fill out the college fastest runners, which is, I mean, it's just a little bit different in college baseball, and you know, that's probably going to change here in the next 3 years. Going back to the CBA, which I said I didn't want to talk a lot about during the podcast, but here it is again. It's definitely a theme. But as more of these college players more of these high school players kind of on the bubble wind up in college, I think you're going to see the college game become more athletic.
Here's a different one, Nathan. I'll ask this to you. Like, one of the most intriguing ones to me is best fastball. I mean, we have a decent amount of guys on the college side who fill it up, but the high school side, there are a lot of guys bringing 97, 98 cheddar. I mean, we don't even have, for best fastball, we don't even have Joey Gallo on here, do we? And Joey Gallo, you guys, we have video of him hitting 98.
We put him in for best arm, but since we're listing him as a position player,
first. I mean, we have video of him hitting 98 at NHSI, right? I mean,
we do.
I mean, this is big time velocity, but Giolito, McCullers Jr., Hensley, Sims, Smorrell, Berrios, Zach Eflin, Nick Travieso. That seems like that's one. Last year's class was exceptional for velocity. It doesn't feel like this year's is exceptional, but at least it's not weak in terms of velocity.
Well, absolutely. It certainly isn't on the level it was last year, but it's definitely good once again. And, you know, that's the thing that Connor and I were talking about when we were lining up the high school prospects early on. You know, it seems like there's always a hard-throwing right-hander out of high school, and that's why we opted to put Buxton number one as the top prospect in high school, because we felt his tool set was a little more rare. That's no discredit to Lucas Giolito. Yes, he throws hard, and there are plenty of hard-throwing right-handers in high school, but Giolito also brings a lot more to the table, you know, when he's healthy. than the typical high school right-hander. But there certainly isn't a shortage of big velocity this year, especially when you consider some of the guys that were putting out big velocity, you know, even last year might not be doing so last year. I know this year, Weichel, you know, was never really a huge velocity guy, but, you know, you'd see some threes and fours out of him. But as you're getting in your reports, you're just not seeing that this year. And then you're seeing the guys, like last year when I saw Zach Eflin, he was 89 to 91. And, you know, this year he's now sitting low to mid-90s and touching a little higher. Travieso, I've seen 89 to 92 touching some fours, and now he's taking that step forward. You know, it's kind of like Taylor Guerrieri last year. You know, on the showcase circuit, he was anywhere from 88 to 92, and then he comes out and he's 93 to 95. So there's really, it doesn't really ever feel like there's a shortage of velocity when it comes to the high school right-handers.
Yeah, but this year, to me, I think it really seems like it helped, Connor, that guys like Travieso, some guys like him took some real steps forward in terms of going from good velocity to kind of elite velocity.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But the other one that can be tough is best strike zone judgment for high school players. Because, you know, just like the scouts have to deal with when they go to these games, I mean, that's why scouts love not only the summer showcase circuit, but matchup games. You know, in the springtime, they have all those games circled in their schedule books where they can see a hitter they're interested in against a guy who's throwing, you know, mid-80s, upper-80s, into the 90s if they're lucky or depending on their area. But the strike zone judgment can be very difficult to judge for the high school players just because they're not typically facing quality pitchers.
Well, they all go to the high school blog at the during the high school preview and look at the matchups of the year.
There you go.
That's the place to go. If they're smart, that's where they go. Baseball America podcast with John and Connor and Nathan. Guys, let's wrap up by just talking a little bit about our regions. I think we discussed it a little bit. But just overall strengths, weaknesses. What's the Northeast and the Carolinas look like for you, Nathan? You know, besides just the guys who kind of jumped up, what's just your general? What's the vibe been among scouts up there? Good, bad, indifferent. Wait till next year. You know, kind of what's the? Got any five-star states up that way?
I don't think we're gonna have any five-star states. Except, you know, you might argue New York. There isn't a lot of elite talent out of New York this year. But there's certainly some depth when you're talking about the guys at Stony Brook, at St. John's, and then Tom Murphy at Buffalo. And then, you know, if you want to talk about it, you can talk about the high school guys, you know, who aren't in the top 200, but, you know, the Fernella Sanchez's of the world who have, you know, big tools, but it doesn't really translate to the game. So that might be the only one that I would even argue for. But in the Northeast, it's just kind of a middle-of-the-road vibe. You know, you got some guys that, you know, the scouts like, but they don't get really excited about when you're talking to them on the phone. And then in the Mid-Atlantic in the South, South Carolina, North Carolina, it's kind of, you know, outside of those guys like Seager and Stroman and Schaefer, it's kind of a mixed bag. You know, you got Eddie Butler, you know, in Virginia who can bump some 97s and 98s, but his secondary stuff is a question, and I think that probably has led to, you know, why his strikeout numbers aren't what you would think they would be in the Big South, as you've mentioned, John. And then you got Brandon Klein, who we all know has a, you know, power stuff with the fastball and the slider, but the delivery that he has just isn't conducive to his frame and his style of pitching, and he's kind of had a roller coaster year. You know, in North Carolina, obviously you got Stroman. But Cody Stubbs has been a disappointment at North Carolina. There's too many holes in his swing, a lot of swing and miss. Tommy Coyle, you know, guys knew he probably wasn't a shortstop, but he, you know, might be a left-handed offensive second baseman, and, you know, he's been a bit of a disappointment as well. So I would say it's probably a down year aside from those guys at the top, but I do know for sure that they're not saying wait till next year because I have a feeling it might be even worse.
Really? Okay.
I'd hate to mark my word on that one.
All right. I'd hate to see that, though. But I know you're not counting Rhett Wiseman as one of your top guys in the Northeast. So, Connor, you can...
Rhett Wiseman, just not as much as Connor.
I love Rhett Wiseman.
he's a great athlete, and yes, he's a great kid. He is.
I think we all know who Connor's personal cheese ball is in this draft.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a lot. I love cheese balls.
We know.
Cheese ball.
Wiseman is very well put together, very physical kid. It's just a lot of swing and miss to his game, and his swing, there's not a lot of body control to it. He needs to tone things down, but he does have a couple of things that you can't really teach. He's got really good speed. He's got really good bat speed. So, you know, things might be able to click for him, but I think he's a guy that, you know, he's going to have to go to Vanderbilt and figure things out there. There's a bet board brewing between Connor and myself on Rhett Wiseman. Just haven't figured out the exact parameters yet.
I told Nate that. Pick your terms. I'll take Wiseman. Anyway,
you need Rhett Wiseman to set the terms since he responds to email and text. What's the vibe like out west, Connor? I know you don't do Southern California, but I mean, I was just looking back to some recent drafts. 2006 is the last draft where one of the top 25 picks was not a Southern California player. That year, James Simmons was the best of a bad lot in Southern California, and he, of course, did not have much of a career with the Oakland Athletics. But so Southern California is part of the West, and it's not part of your region per se, but we all know, we've talked about all year, that SoCal is down, but it feels like the rest of the West is at least okay. You know, not horrible, but
well,
okay.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, NorCal, probably at least four stars, could be five stars in NorCal. I mean, it's pretty loaded at the top. There's a bunch of interesting high school players. Puerto Rico's definitely five stars with it, you know, with Correa, he's going to be the highest drafted Puerto Rican ever, more than likely. I mean, the current record is 17th overall.
Oh yeah, he's going to bust that.
Ramon Castro, and that was just a couple months before Correa was born. But other than that, I mean, Washington is just okay. Washington and Oregon both kind of have their one guy that stands out, and they're right across the river from each other, and with Clint Coulter in Washington and Carson Kelly in Oregon. But after that, it kind of drops off a little bit for both states. Washington is a little bit better. You know, that's an unbiased comment right there. But Washington is a little bit better than Oregon, you know, because there's a little more pitching. In our top 200, there's Adrian Sampson, who, you know, was drafted last year in the 16th round, didn't sign, is back at Bellevue Community College, or Bellevue College now, I guess. And then Mitch Geller, who's been kind of the pop-up guy out there in the Northwest, is an athletic right-hander that's been up to 94. And listeners of the podcast would know about him if they read Draft Tracker. But
nice.
NorCal and Puerto Rico are the standouts in my area.
But the
Four Corners
is kind of empty.
Is
huh?
Down. Yeah, the Four Corners is down, and Oregon's down because there's just not a lot of guys at Oregon and Oregon State. I mean, those are the schools that drive Oregon, and you know, at Oregon, Christian Jones is hurt, and there's not a lot after him as far as, you know, top 5 round, top 6 round guys, maybe even top 10 round guys, and then Oregon State is young. I mean, their team's pretty much being led right now by the two freshmen that come from Washington. So, there you go.
That's another example of how Washington is better than Oregon, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Again, Connor's, that's it. Connor's, of course, from the well, what state is it, though?
Evergreen State.
I got it. The Evergreen State.
Yep.
Well, it feels like the talent's in the Southeast. So, we have 95 scouting reports in the first two rounds in the early draft preview, the part one of the draft preview. I think I wrote 36 of those for guys in the Southeast. So it feels like the Southeast, I have basically all the states that used to be in the Confederacy except for the Carolinas and Texas. And it feels like those states are providing the bulk of especially the offensive players, whether it's David Dahl, Albert Almora. I mean, I wrote up like 8 center fielders. Albert Almora, David Dahl, the two football players, Anthony Alford and Jamius Winston, whether they sign or not, more likely not.
Buxton, of course.
DJ Davis, and of course, exactly, Byron Buxton. So that's, you know, the scouts I've talked to in the Southeast have all been very busy, and they've all talked about other scouts from other regions coming into their region. I mean, even like Arkansas's got a couple guys in Devon McClure, a high schooler. Maybe DJ Baxendale's younger brother, I forget his first name, I think it's Brett Baxendale, He could go out in a single. Blake, thank you. He could go out with a single digit pick. Who's the pitcher? It's not Ty Hensley. It's another Trey Killian. He could go out if people have seen him on the right day. So even Arkansas, and of course the college team, hasn't been quite up to what people expected out of it. But you still have Nolan Sandberg bumping some 99s, and you still have other pitching depth there. And Matt Reynolds is a solid college bat, and otherwise, I think he's propped up by the fact that it's a bad year for college hitters, and he's fairly athletic, should be able to stay on the dirt, probably a future utility guy, kind of a Russ Johnson kind of player. But, I mean, every state in the Southeast, with the exception of Tennessee, I think feels like it's a little bit better than usual. Maybe Alabama's a little bit down because the college teams there are just okay, or I should say actually are bad. Alabama's bad. Auburn is not so good.
But then again, how often do they have a guy like David Dahl?
And no, that's what I'm saying. On the high school side, it is. On the college side, but you also have Lex Rutledge, and you have one of my personal cheese balls, Brandon Miller. Very interesting player. To put it in BA recent draft terms, he's kind of like Luke Merton, who might be able to catch. that's inconceivable when you really think about it. But he's a right corner outfielder who's hit 34 home runs the last 2 years and did catch as a freshman at Georgia Tech and is working out for teams as a catcher now. So could be, I think it's going to be a really good senior sign, like an 11 to 10th round and up senior sign bonus, kind of a guy who helps you spread out the rest of your bonus pool. So I've already given my personal cheese ball. I know you said you have lots of them, Connor. You already said Rhett Wiseman. Let's close this off with you and Nathan, give your guys who aren't top 200 guys but are personal cheese balls.
Well, mine's easy. Mine's been the same one for 3 years. don't laugh.
You
can legitimate.
Pick somebody else.
Washington
pick somebody
State,
else.
Redshirt Junior, Taylor Ard.
I appreciate your stick-to-itiveness, but you're welcome to pick someone else.
What?
You're welcome to pick someone else, though.
Oh, no, I'm good. I'm
sticking to his guns.
Monogamous.
I believe you're convicted.
Yes.
The phrase. What do you got there? What do you got there, Nathan?
I'm going to pull a fast one, and my guy is now eligible to be a non-top 200 cheese ball because he's not eligible for the draft. Nathan Kirby. Keep an eye on this guy.
Cheating, dude.
He's going to go to Virginia. I think he could see a similar path to Danny Halston. I don't know. I don't think he's going to be the number two pick, but he could be a first rounder, as high as a mid first rounder after 3 years at the University of Virginia. He officially removed himself from the draft this week by not turning in the required information and the waivers, the submitting to the drug testing and releasing your medical records to the scouting bureau, so he can't be picked. But he's a left-hander that I've seen him 88 to 91 touching some twos. He can be down in the zone. He's got a good frame, 6'2", in that kind of 180, 190 pound range. But he's got a really good hard curveball that's got downer action to it, and it sits 77 to 80 miles an hour. So I think he's going to be one of those guys that goes to UVA, and you're going to be hearing his name if everything goes right in the first round in 3 years.
What does he think about bending at the knee before he delivers a pitch?
Well, I assume he's okay with it because he's committed there. And
how does he like? How does he like?
That's
towel
what
drills.
They do.
Yeah, he better like towel drills.
Yep.
I mean, that's what's in his future. So yeah, good stuff, guys. It sounds like you guys are. Nathan, you're getting ready to hit the road, and Connor, you're welcome to drop in on the podcast tomorrow with me and Jim. We certainly don't have to bogart as we go over some first-round projections, and it's awfully early to do that, but it's also fun to do. So the draft is too big to be contained by one podcast, so we're gonna make it two here this week at Baseball America. We hope you enjoyed it, and remember to follow us for all your draft news on Twitter, at Connor Glassy, at BA High School. I'm at John Manuel BA, or just at Baseball America.
Or here on the podcast. Until tomorrow's part two of the Mega Draft Pod, we'll see you next time. So long, everybody.